The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
It was Becky's fault. Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me, and my view of the courtroom also informs me, that we have lots of students visiting us this morning, which is wonderful. The first people on my list are those from Evansville High School. Would you please stand with your advisor? Thank you. Thank you for coming, and please be seated. And the next group of students is Wayland Academy in Beaver Dam. Will you please stand? Oh, thank you for venturing over from Beaver Dam. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us this morning. When the argument is over, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits right over here to the right, will come down and talk to the students. I'm going to come down briefly just to say hello and goodbye because I have another meeting over the lunch hour. But anybody else that wants to stay for Justice Ziegler's discussion certainly is welcome to do that. I'm going to call our second case, but before I do, you will notice that the chair to my right, where Justice Shirley Abraham's son generally sits, is not filled, and she is not appearing by phone either. She has withdrawn from participation, so we sit six on this matter. With that in mind, State versus Pegues, are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court, Assistant State Public Defender Tom Aquino appearing for the petitioner, Javian Pegues. Before accepting a plea, all federal judges and all judges in about two-thirds of the state must review with the defendant each of the constitutional rights that will be waived by the plea. We're asking this court today to clarify that Wisconsin judges likewise, before accepting a plea, must review each of the rights being waived by that plea and cannot rely on reference to a form filled out by the defendant before the plea.
Counsel, why should we believe that because the judge says with his or her mouth what counsel has reviewed independently in a quiet place where two can talk, that the defendant will better understand the counts against him, the rights that he is waiving, and I think you focus mostly on the rights that he's waiving. Why should we believe that what someone hears in court, they're going to understand better than what counsel has explained?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, this court has, and the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently said that it is with dialogue with the defendant that the court fulfills its obligation to make sure that a plea is actually entered into voluntarily. In Hampton, there was a plea questionnaire that was filled out where the questionnaire indicated that the defendant understood that the judge was not bound by the joint recommendation by the parties. Nonetheless, the judge did not directly inform the defendant of this and through dialogue verify that the defendant understood this. And the court, the court said that the defendant was entitled to an evidentiary hearing where it could be examined by the court through testimony both from the defendant and the defense attorney about whether the defendant actually understood this aspect of the plea colloquy. Now, similarly, in Brown, it didn't involve a questionnaire, but it did involve an attorney's representation during the plea colloquy that the attorney had reviewed the nature of the case with the with the defendant, and the court, this court again said that that the case demonstrates why the representations of the attorney do not suffice, because it is only with that personal dialogue that the court can truly understand whether the defendant is voluntarily entering into the plea.
Well, I you know, there was a colloquy, and the judge here didn't rely totally on the questionnaire, and of course, it, you know, we have to show that a plea is entered knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. But to have the understanding that is required, we want to have a procedure that is best for the defendant to be able to understand. I guess I've always perceived that a defendant appearing before a judge is going to be very stressed. Most defendants say, yes, no, yes, no. I wouldn't ever expect a defendant to recite what's involved in every right that's being waived. You can name them, but I'm not sure that really makes you understand them. And that's, of course, why we want counsel to discuss these with the defendant, too.
Right. Well, it's not an either-or. Certainly, the attorney to fill their duty of responsibility to their client needs to, when recommending whether to take a plea or not, has to explain all these rights that are being waived in the context of the facts of the case. There's no denying that. We're not asking to let attorneys off the hook and not have to do that. This is, you know, but the court has an independent duty to determine that that these rights are being waived voluntarily. And the court, by going over the rights, can, you know, make sure that the attorney has had enough time to go over all the rights, and that the defendant does understand all of the rights. There's oftentimes, you know, being in the public defender's office, I've read a number of plea colloquies, and there will be occasions where a defendant, perhaps because of a learning disability or for some other reason, the plea colloquy judge will ask the defendant to explain each of the rights being waived in the defendant's own terms. And in those cases, there's no way to challenge whether that the defendant doesn't understand those rights being waived. Those are bulletproof, frankly. So what we're asking, again, is for the court to make clear that the judges have to review each of these so that they can give the defendant who is more concerned about getting out of jail, going home, possibly. Maybe only had a couple of conversations with their attorney in a busy hallway, or other side of a very scratchy telephone in jail. And maybe the judge, by going over each individual right, the defendant will. Sometimes defendants will speak up and say, actually, I want more time to speak with my attorney. They get that time.
Counsel, at page 5 of your reply brief, you mentioned the circuit court, and I quote, asked Pegues if he understood the rights he was giving up without explicitly referring to the questionnaire. And you emphasized the phrase, without explicitly referring to the questionnaire. Is it your position that the colloquy would have been sufficient if the court had explicitly referred to the questionnaire?
No. It's not under the what's called the Mordendorfer rule, where there was, which the state says applies and should be sufficient. Our position is that even under that rule, the colloquy was insufficient, because in Mordendorfer there was this explicit reference back to the plea questionnaire.
Right.
And,
that's,
and to the rights in the plea questionnaire.
If that's what made it sufficient, if Mordendorfer was sufficient because it referred to the plea questionnaire, wouldn't this colloquy have been sufficient if it had?
Well, we're asking for, the problem is, and why we're asking for a clear rule that the court has to refer to each of the rights and not rely
right,
on the form.
Before you get to that, so I ultimately I'm trying to figure out what we need to do with Mordendorfer, right? Because if we accept your position about what the court ought to do, then we've got to overrule Mordendorfer. But first I want to figure out whether the plea colloquy was sufficient under Modendorfer, and if not, what the difference was.
Okay. No, it was not sufficient under Modendorfer because there wasn't, under my understanding of the logic of Modendorfer is that there was this explicit reference during the colloquy to the rights within the questionnaire.
Right.
And then what Modendorfer, just pull up. So as Modendorfer, the judge said, you give up rights, and these rights have been detailed in this three-page waiver of rights form. The form had the defendant's initials next to each of the constitutional rights, and then the circuit court asked the defendant whether his initials signified that he read each of the paragraphs and understood them, and the defendant answered, yes, Your Honor, each and every one of them. So there is, in Modendorfer, this explicit reference to the questionnaire.
Yes. Now, in the Modendorfer colloquy, the court never actually mentioned constitutional rights. It just referred to the rights in the questionnaire, right?
Right.
Okay. So what I'm wondering then is, if the colloquy here had included a reference to the questionnaire, would it have been sufficient under Modendorfer?
It's hard to say because it depends on how it was actually referenced. And this is one of our points about why there needs to be a clear rule, because there's all this litigation on what's a proper reference to the questionnaire and what's an improper reliance or substitution of the questionnaire.
Are you asking us to develop a script for the circuit courts to read?
No, and this court has been able to impose duties on the court on the circuit courts without requiring a script.
So tell me, to make this a Modendorfer compliant colloquy, what would the circuit court have had to say in reference to the plea questionnaire?
It would have to say exactly what was said in Modendorfer.
Exactly.
Would be my position, which would be
word for
that
word.
There's a specific, it would be verifying that it was the defendant who had, in this case, the questionnaire, there are check marks. It's not on the record. It doesn't indicate who put the check marks on there, when the check marks were put on there. There weren't, as opposed to initials.
So if the court said, are those your check marks on there? And he says yes. Then that would have been sufficient.
No, I mean, that would have been necessary.
Okay.
But it would have been necessary for the court to verify that there was a discussion with his attorney about each of these rights and that he understood all of those rights, that he had enough time to discuss them, that he understood that he was waiving all of those rights by entering the plea.
Which of the rights is it that Mr. Pegues did not understand?
He understood that he had the right to trial, but it's all of the other rights that,
looking at the form, he didn't understand he had a right to remain silent. He didn't understand he had a right to testify. He didn't understand he had a right to use subpoenas to require witnesses. He didn't understand he had a right to a jury trial. He didn't understand he had a right to confront people who would testify against him. He didn't understand he had a right to make the state prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. He didn't understand any of that.
He was a 16-year-old kid.
Well,
at the
time.
Well,
I know he may be 16 years old, but we had a lot of young people in the courtroom today, and I would be surprised if they didn't understand them if someone had talked to them about them.
Well, that's why we need an evidentiary hearing to determine how much the attorney actually discussed this with Mr. Pegues in the context of the facts of the case to determine whether he really understood what he was giving up by entering the plea.
Basically, your position is the only thing he understood was that he was giving up his right to a trial.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So when the circuit court asked him if he understood the constitutional rights, plural, that he was giving up, what is your position about what he understood about that?
Well, I don't want to testify for him. At this point, what we've said is that he did not understand his rights. At the hearing, there would be a discussion about why he answered that. I mean, I can speculate about why a 16-year-old kid would, go along to get along.
When we look at the plea colloquy in Modendorfer, we're speculating there too about what the defendant actually understood. Right? We're not looking at a subjective analysis. we're looking at an objective analysis, right? So we look at the plea colloquy in Modendorfer and we say, yeah, you know, that's reasonably calculated to get to his understanding of the rights that he's waiving. So what is it that after having gone through the plea questionnaire, signing the plea questionnaire, and then it being asked by the court, do you understand the constitutional rights that you're giving up? A question that not even Modendorfer asked. What is your position on whether that is reasonably calculated to focus his mind on the constitutional rights that he's waiving?
Well, I've just focused on the reality of the situation of when there's a 16-year-old who's been held in jail for a while, wants to get out. I think it wouldn't be surprising that in the face of authority, asking if you understand something is at that point going to say, just agree with the judge at that point.
Is the rule you're asking us to develop specific to 16-year-olds?
No. I mean, this should apply to every defendant, whether they're, no matter what their age, whether they're represented by counsel or not, because they're pro se attorneys defendants.
Yeah, so Lynn, let's talk about this without reference to Mr. Pegues's age. So what is it about the failure to reference explicitly the questionnaire made the colloquy insufficient? The court specifically asked him if he understood the constitutional rights he was giving up. Your brief, if I read it correctly, seems to suggest that he thought, well, that's got nothing to do with the questionnaire. He's asking me about something else. Where do you derive that from?
Well, if you don't understand something, you may not realize that you don't understand something. That's just the way. Again, I don't want to testify for him.
I don't want you to either, because we're not talking about his subjective. We're talking about whether the plea colloquy was reasonably designed to get to an understanding of whether he understood the rights that he was waiving. So your brief says, well, look, he very well may have court was all done talking about the plea questionnaire. Now he's talking about these constitutional rights, and he wouldn't have any idea what the... So tell me about how that would occur if he just got done talking about the plea questionnaire, in which it lists all the constitutional rights that he's waiving, that a question about the constitutional rights that he's waiving would not, in his mind, reasonably connect to the plea questionnaire that they were just talking about.
Well, first off, I would say that ultimately it is a subjective question whether he actually understood, because if he did not understand subjectively the rights that he was waiving, then his plea and his waiver was in violation of his due process rights. So it's not a subjective test. It's not an objective test. It's a subjective test.
Well, you've got to get a little over an objective hurdle first, right? I mean, you don't just get to come to court after entering a plea and say, oh, by the way, I didn't understand, and then have the court go, okay, well, we'll go back and do it again. There is an objective hurdle you have to get over, right?
Right. And the objective hurdle in Bangert-type cases is that there's a defect in the colloquy.
That's where we're at right now. So what I'm trying to figure out is, in your brief, you say, well, they just got done talking about the plea questionnaire and then asked about the constitutional rights without referring to the plea questionnaire. And in a reasonable person's mind, they would make no connection between the two. So I want to know how that works.
Well, it's because if you don't realize that there are constitutional rights in the questionnaire, when the judge talks to you, well, do you understand your constitutional rights? It has no context.
So what you're saying is that the way that this colloquy would have been, I understand what you're arguing for, but if we weren't saying that judges need to give each of these rights individually, what you would rather see, or what you believe needs to be seen, is a connection directly between the question which he asked, which was, Mr. Pegues, do you understand the constitutional rights you give up when you enter a plea today? And he said, yes, sir. Any questions about those rights? No, sir. You would have the colloquy require it to be more like, do you understand the constitutional rights listed in the plea questionnaire form? Did you go over those rights with your attorney? And do you understand that you're giving up those rights today? Or something to that effect. Is
yes.
that the distinction you're focusing on? Is the connection
yes.
in the same context between not constitutional rights in general, but those listed specifically in the plea questionnaire form?
Yes.
Okay, so some kind of language to that effect.
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, I want to start with your assertion about all of the other jurisdictions and that Wisconsin, according to your assertion, is kind of being left behind in the dust. All federal courts, you say, are required to specifically to address the defendant and must inform the defendant of and determine that the defendant understands the following. The defendant may or may not be placed under oath. And then in Federal Rule 11, it goes through each individual right. You also mention all of a number of, I guess it was in total about 42 jurisdictions, but 30 jurisdictions that did it by rule. I always, since my youth, I've always compared Wisconsin to surrounding states in a competitive spirit. And I look at Minnesota's rule, and I look at Iowa's rule, and I look at Illinois' rule, and they all require the same kind of thing, that the defendant, I guess in Minnesota, must be sworn and questioned by the judge with the assistance of counsel and then goes through specific rights listed one right after the other. So all of them do that, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. I haven't looked at all of the states that you referenced, but I have looked at those and the federal courts all follow. Do these courts ultimately, does the federal case law and the law of these states say, okay, in order to accomplish what we have specifically detailed in our rule, I mean, in Wisconsin's rule, let me preface the question a little bit more. Wisconsin has a rule, and it is 97108, which says, before the court accepts a plea of guilty or no contest, it shall do all of the following. Address the defendant personally and determine that the plea is made voluntarily with understanding of the nature of the charge and the potential punishment if convicted. So ours is much briefer than everyone else's. I think most of these are done by court rule of the states. But this looks good. They're all printed. They all have the list that the judge, it says, must do. But has the case law interpreting these said something like, but in order to comply with this directive, it's good enough that you ask, have you gone over this form with your attorney? Do you understand this form? Do you have any question about this form? Have they essentially neutered what they have put in the rules?
I haven't looked into, all the cases, all the different states. I looked into how the federal courts handle it, and I described that in the reply brief. Wisconsin's post-conviction procedure is a bit different than the federal system and most other states in that the first step is a direct review. There isn't any kind of post-conviction hearing where there's an evidentiary hearing.
Yeah.
And then after that direct review is made, where depending on the case, they'll look at the record to see whether the requirements of the rule were substantially complied with. I don't know. I mean,
Let me move on then. When I look at Modendorfer, and it came out when I was on
the circuit court. And I remember watching the district of the Court of Appeals that issued this and watching how over the years they've kind of shifted and modified, at least in my view, pulling back. Nettesheim wrote one of the opinions. Lopez was subsequently written by Brown, the author of Moten Doffer. The three of them all kind of were on the same panel and progressed and edged a little bit about what it meant. But I want to go back to Moten Doffer. And it apparently was getting a reading from Bangert. You mentioned Wisconsin has a post-conviction proceeding that doesn't exist in the federal courts. And a post-conviction proceeding in this regard is set forth in our case called Bangert. And Moten Doffer starts out by quoting how they read Bangert and then what is necessary. And it states that henceforth will also require as a function of our supervisory powers that the state courts at the plea hearing follow the provisions set forth in Special Materials 32. Then, the next thing that a lot of people focus on in this kind of a question, rights or specifically refer to some portion of the record or communication between defense counsel, etc. Then it goes on to say, you not only, though, can just refer to that, it says, the court must then, as before, ascertain whether the defendant understood he will be waiving certain constitutional rights by virtue of his guilty or no contest plea. And, of course, as you said, in Motendorfer, each paragraph of each right was initialed by the defendant on the form, and they said, you know, sufficient enough. When you started your oral argument, I didn't think you were as precise as I would like. You said this court should have the judge review each of these. You should have the court go over each. What do you mean by review? Now, we have the word refer. We know that that's floating around in our case law. I mean, tell me specifically what you believe should be required or is required under our case law.
I think the rule should be that the plea judge must inform the defendant of each of the constitutional rights being waived by the plea and verify that the defendant understands that each of those rights will be waived by entering the plea.
So you want what the other states around us are doing, the court to say you have the right, the rights are on the plea advisement and waiver of rights form that I used to rattle, well, I didn't mean to say that, that I used to give in court. You understand you have the right to a trial, you have the right to remain silent, and anything you say could be used against you. You have the right to testify and present evidence, and that you have the right to have all 12 jurors unanimously agree that you are guilty before you can be found guilty. You have the right to testify, as I said, or you can remain silent. You have the right to make the state prove. We used to go through all of that stuff, even after Mordendorfer. And that's what you're asking, again, for that kind of a listing?
Yes.
Okay.
Just to clarify, it doesn't, like in the special materials, some of the rights are grouped together because conceptually they're very similar, and the question of do you understand isn't necessarily after each individual right, but there is, each individual right is articulated, and the judge is the one who's informing the defendant of them and has an opportunity through dialogue to verify that the defendant understands each of those rights.
Thank you. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill, on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. The use of plea questionnaire forms by circuit courts to obtain a pleading defendant's waiver of his or her constitutional rights is an established practice in Wisconsin. Both this Court and the Court of Appeals have approved of the form's use for this purpose. This court's decisions and the decisions of the Court of Appeals established that to obtain a valid waiver using the form, the circuit court must, in addition to relying on the form, conduct a colloquy with the defendant. The issue in this case is whether the circuit court's colloquy was sufficient to show that the defendant knew and understood his constitutional rights and that he was waiving them by entering his plea. The state is asking this court to hold that the circuit court's colloquy with the defendant was sufficient. The court relied on the standard plea questionnaire that listed the defendant's rights. It confirmed with the defendant that he had read and signed this document, that he understood its contents. It asked him whether he had any questions. It asked him if he understood the rights that he was waiving by pleading guilty. And it asked him if he had any questions about those rights. Under the decisions of this court and the Court of Appeals, this colloquy was sufficient.
What about the lack of reference to constitutional rights? Is that of any moment?
In the
colloquy?
Colloquy, I believe.
Oh, there is a constitutional
court,
reference.
Court did mention
right.
Constitutional rights. I think the issue in this case, as Justice Kelly pointed out, is whether the absence of a reference to the plea questionnaire, the rights on the plea questionnaire, is fatal to the causes a defect in the during the colloquy, and it's the state's position that it does not. The state concedes that there does have to be a connection between, on one hand, the court's question about the constitutional rights and the plea questionnaire, if a plea questionnaire is used. Our position is that connection is present here just by virtue of the questions that the court asked, that the court began asking the defendant questions about the plea questionnaire, asked him whether he had read it and understood it, then turned to his attorney and confirmed, asked similar questions of the attorney, and then immediately asked, do you understand the constitutional rights you're waiving today? As the Court of Appeals explained in its decision, that the connection between the plea questionnaire and the court's questions is obvious from the context.
So did you want to
go? If I may.
Okay.
If the question had not been, do you understand the constitutional rights, and just been, do you understand your rights, would that have been a defective colloquy?
I don't think so. I think in the context of a plea hearing, the question is the defendant's constitutional rights that they're waiving. That's only the relevant issue.
How do you square that with the Court of Appeals opinion written by Nettesheim, but Brown and Anderson also is their post-Modendorfer, where they really say, we meant more than just, do you understand this? You meant more than in Hansen. The colloquy was limited to whether Hansen had gone over the Mordendorfer form with his attorney before he signed it and whether Hansen understood the form. We conclude that such limited personal colloquy is not the substantive kind of personal exchange between the trial court and the defendant which Bangert and Mordendorfer require. So just saying you've gone over the form, do you understand it, do you have any questions about it, isn't sufficient, apparently, either in Hansen or in Lopez, which was the published opinion.
I'll start with Hansen. I think, and the problem with Hansen is there was no mention of the defendant's rights at all during the colloquy. It was just, have you gone over the plea questionnaire with your attorney? That's what distinguishes this case from that one.
So if in Hansen, if it had been, do you understand these rights? I mean, you've gone over the form. Do you understand the form? Do you have any questions about the form? Do you understand your rights? That would have been sufficient.
Our position is that would be sufficient. That's essentially what happened here. The only difference being, as you pointed out, the court did specify constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think under the circumstances that should make a difference.
So the court need not make any reference to constitutional rights, but can just say, as I said, have you gone over the form? Do you understand the form? Do you have any questions about the form? Do you understand your rights? And that's sufficient.
Correct.
And I heard you agree that you do have to have a connection between the constitutional rights and the form.
Correct.
You're reading that connection into the placement in the colloquy, as I understand you, and you're saying that they don't need to specifically say the constitutional rights in the form, or even the constitutional, apparently. You could just say the rights. As long as you say it right after you're talking about the plea questionnaire.
And yes, and I think the connection between the questionnaire and the court's questions is obvious because the court was just talking about the plea questionnaire itself. And again, whether the rights, specifying that the rights were constitutional is also obvious because, again, the court was referring to the plea questionnaire, which discusses the defendant's constitutional rights there. We don't require any other rights to be waived during a plea colloquy.
So if he had gone on, if the judge had gone on to talk about something in between those two, you would agree that then there wouldn't be the connection there necessarily?
I think it would depend on each individual case. If there were several pages of transcript between...
If he started talking about the medications he took that day,
sure,
that's one of the things that's on the form.
Absolutely. I think there might be, without a reference to the questionnaire itself, if the court had gone on and done additional things that it's required to do as part of a plea colloquy, there could be a problem here. Again, I think the record just has to show that there is a connection and in present just by virtue of the way the court asked the questions.
What do you do with the language of Mordendorfer that was interpreting and applying Bangert? And it referenced the Bangert court's requirement of referring to something in the record. Here would have been the plea questionnaire. And then after that, and making sure that the defendant exhibits knowledge of the constitutional rights he's waiving, okay? Then it says the court must then, as before, ascertain whether the defendant understands he will be waiving certain constitutional rights. And later on in the opinion, they emphasize that he understood each of the paragraphs he had initialed. So what do you do with these words in Mordendorfer about certain rights and understanding each of the rights?
I think the connection here in this case is obvious because we're always talking about a defendant's constitutional rights when the court uses a plea questionnaire. I don't think my recollection of Mordendorfer is that the court didn't specify any of the constitutional rights there. It just referred to the plea questionnaire and the rights being waived there. So
yes, but he highlighted that after each right listed, the defendant had initialed put his initials after each of the rights.
That's correct. And in this case, the court or the check boxes are marked on this on the plea questionnaire. And by signing the plea questionnaire, the defendant acknowledged that either he or his counsel signed those.
Yeah,
and gone over those.
Mordendorfer says that the judge went over. The judge did this. Asked if he understood each of the paragraphs he had initialed. The defendant replied affirmatively to each question. We hold that there was no error because he went over each of the paragraphs he initialed and the defendant replied affirmatively. The each and certain seemed to have fallen out of the equation. Where did it go?
I don't think Mordendorfer was setting what happened there as the minimum allowable colloquy that the court has to conduct with the defendant. And I'd ask this court to, if it's going to address Mordendorfer in this case, to distinguish it on that basis and accept the rule that we've proposed.
So you want a minimum lesser, a floor lower. How low can we go? A floor lower than Mordendorfer. In your opinion, Mordendorfer was too high.
I don't think what happened there was too high, and I don't think the Court of Appeals was saying that this has to happen in every case. I think the court, what happened in Mordendorfer was an exemplary plea colloquy that obviously if the court had followed, done something similar here, it would be fine. But I don't think that's the bare minimum that the requires.
You want the bare minimum. That's what you're advancing.
I think we need to set the floor for the bare minimum and find out whether what happened in this case met it.
Did the court in Mordendorfer go over each of the paragraphs and ask if the defendant had initialed each of the paragraphs?
Did it go over by listing the right, or just did it ask? It confirmed that he had, my recollection is that he confirmed that he had initialed next to each paragraph.
Right. So the part of the colloquy I'm looking at, the court asked, are these your initials in the columns of each of these three pages? That's correct. And these initials signify that you've read each of the paragraphs and that you understand them before you placed your initials on them. Is that correct? And he said yes. But I don't recall seeing anything where the judge went through each of the paragraphs and said, did you initial that one, and then initial that one, and initial that one. Is that right? Or did
That's my recollection. I mean, and I think if that had happened, there would be some reference. I don't know how the court would necessarily do that without at least referring to some part of the rights listed in on the colloquy, or excuse me, on the questionnaire. Just like briefly address the Mr. Pegues' proposal to require courts to personally inform the defendants during their plea colloquies of the rights that they are waiving. He suggests that this is required because the law is unclear, but as we've argued in our brief, any lack of clarity in the law can be cleared up in this court's opinion, and we believe that the law, as is really established by Mordendorfer on one hand and Hansen on the other, clearly sets out what's permissible and what's not.
What about the idea that all these other jurisdictions are requiring this, including the federal courts? And I think I had heard 2/3 of the jurisdictions, but certainly the ones surrounding. Why wouldn't we afford that extra protection also?
We already afford extra protection than these jurisdictions by having the Bangert process. We allow a defendant to seek to withdraw a plea post-sentencing for any error during or to seek to withdraw, a plea after sentencing for any error that happens that he can point to during the plea colloquy and a bare-bones assertion that he did not understand the information that wasn't provided or whatever else the problem with the error that the court committed was. So Wisconsin already has a very generous pleading standard allowing defendants to seek to withdraw their pleas. My understanding, and I can't speak for every jurisdiction that has been discussed in the state's briefs, but in the federal system, that's just not the case.
No, there it isn't true in the federal system. But in how about the other states? Are you suggesting that they don't have a post-conviction proceeding?
Most, in my understanding of post-direct appeal proceedings in most states, and again, I'm not an expert, and I don't want to represent anything inaccurately, but most states follow the federal system in that direct appeals proceed immediately from a conviction, and there is no outside the record post-conviction proceeding like we have under 80930 and 97402. I also note that in the federal system, it's the rule itself and case law establishes that any errors of the sort that would lead to a Bangert hearing in Wisconsin are subject to a harmless error analysis. And certainly in the federal system, most plea agreements list all the rights being waived and are basically follow many of the things that are on our standard plea questionnaire, and courts are willing to find a harmless error based on the defendant's representation that he or she signed the plea questionnaire and acknowledged the understanding of its contents.
Are you asking us then to either overrule Bangert or essentially obliterate it?
No, we are not.
Seems to me that a harmless error test does just that.
The harmless error test that we are proposing is what's like the harmless error test in any other situation, but it has to be apparent from the record that the court's error was harmless. It's not always going to be apparent from the record that the court's error was harmless. There is, in my experience, there is rarely anything else, using what the complaint is in this case, there's rarely anything else in the record besides either what happened during the plea colloquy or on the plea questionnaire that the defendant that shows the defendant understood the constitutional rights that he would be waiving by pleading guilty. So I think that, the court's going to be assessing a error for harmlessness is going to be limited to largely probably what happened at the plea colloquy, and it's if there was a plea questionnaire used. And, you know, I think in this case, certainly the error is harmless because the first step I always consider when an error is harmless, well, how severe was the error? And if there was an error here, it was the court's failure to say, do you understand the constitutional rights waiving as they are listed on this questionnaire?
Why do you go to harmless error? Isn't your argument that there was no error, and because there was no deficient colloquy, there's no need for the second prong of the Bangard case? Isn't that your argument?
That is our argument. We're arguing alternatively that an evidentiary hearing isn't necessary here because holding one would essentially require this court to ignore the defendant's representations to the circuit court that he understood what was on the plea questionnaire, that he didn't have any questions about what was on the plea questionnaire, and his signature on the plea questionnaire, that he stating essentially the same things.
Mr. Aquino suggests that the second prong of Bangard is, in essence, a harmless error test. Do you disagree?
I do. It's the harmless test, error test that we're proposing would be limited to the record as it exists at the time the motion is filed, which would essentially be the record of the proceedings leading up to the guilty plea, most likely. Bangard allows the court to expand the record. It allows the state to put on defense counsel as a witness. It allows the state to call the defendant as a witness and cross-examine the defendant about his or her understanding of whatever the error was related to the plea colloquy. So the second part of Bangard, it's not a harmless error analysis.
Does your harmless error test include sufficiency of evidence? In other words, he had a trial, looked like he was, this is a plea hearing though, isn't it?
So, right. Correct.
What else would be included in your harmless error test?
I think first and foremost would be how severe was the error that the court committed. If it is just a minor misstep, the court skipped a word, you know, in saying something here. I think the court skipped a couple words, and we're disputing whether that's an error, but we think if it was, it's a really minor error because it's obvious what the court was talking about. And then again, obviously the court could look to the plea questionnaire and the defendant's representations, not only to the court, but his signature on the questionnaire saying that I do understand these rights and I understand everything on this form.
But you seem to be having a much more holistic approach. I don't know if it's holistic or just larger. Anything that's happened up until the time of the plea, you said. So what are you thinking about?
Well, certainly in a non-constitutional rights context, for example, if the defendant claims that they didn't understand the elements of the crime, oftentimes you can point to something that happened at the initial appearance or the preliminary hearing where the court explained the charges to the defendant and show the defendant's awareness that way.
So like 2 years or a year and a half earlier or a year earlier when he had initial appearance and the charges were read, that would be sufficient then?
It could be under certain circumstances. One last thing I'd like to address, unless the court has more questions, is if this court does adopt Mr. Pegues's proposal to require courts to essentially go through the rights and confirm with the defendant that he understands them before accepting a guilty plea. We'd like that rule to be prospective only. It would mark a significant change in the procedure under Bangard, and we would not like circuit courts to have to undo pleas that they accepted, believing that they had accepted them in compliance with the law at the time it existed. Thank you.
I would just like to highlight one thing that we didn't hear from the state's presentation is simply why not just impose this rule on the courts. There's no argument that requiring judges to review each of the rights being waived is overly burdensome on the courts or that it's overly complicated.
Should we make it prospective only? Should we make it prospective only?
Well, I think it should apply to my client. And that's what the court did in Hampton. The court clarified that the requirement to inform the defendant that the plea, the recommendation is not binding on the judge, the court acknowledged that it wasn't one of the previous Bangert duties. It would be a duty henceforth, but that the defendant in Hampton would get the benefit of that, and so was entitled to a Bangert hearing. So I think Hampton is the model for how to apply this, a rule, what we're proposing prospectively or retroactively. But again, I just want to go back to also highlight all of this discussion today about what's a adequate reference back to the questionnaire would all be a thing of the past. We wouldn't be having these arguments anymore if the judges knew that all they had to do was just review each of the rights.
I would bet you, and I'm not generally a betting woman, but that we'll still have arguments about whether the plea was sufficient.
There'll still be arguments, but it's unlikely if the judge has gone through all of those rights. Just as a practical matter, there may be cases where a defendant still doesn't understand it.
Or maybe he didn't say it quite right, and the way he said it misled the defendant instead of informing the defendant.
Well,
he maybe should have said a little more or a little less.
Well, again, the fact that Bangert sets out these duties, shows that the court can set out duties without requiring a script or requiring, that if there's some slight deviation, that the court can say, well, there was substantial compliance with the duty to review the rights.
Thank you.
As far as the harmless error issue that was raised, I don't know how it would be applied. It would essentially get rid of Bangert. Why not just rely entirely on a signed questionnaire, which this court said in Hoppe that doesn't fulfill the judge's statutory obligation to personally verify that the plea is voluntary. And it just doesn't make sense for the court to say that you can't rely on the questionnaire, but you can rely on one section of the questionnaire. It's just, in my mind, a bit incoherent. And everyone would be better served if it was just a clear rule that the judges, before accepting a plea, must inform the defendant of each right being waived and verify that they understand that by entering the plea.
If the judge read the section labeled constitutional rights that's on the current form and just read it, and as soon as he read it said, do you understand that? Defendant says yes. Then he reads the next one. Do you understand that? Defendant says yes. That's what you want?
That would comply, but I don't think it needs to be even one by one. Like in the special materials, they group some of the rights together. So as long as that information is being conveyed by the judge to the defendant, and the judge has an opportunity to see whether it's sinking into the defendant or there's a look of befuddlement, then maybe the judge should say, do you want some more time with your attorney? And then there's no issue later on that has to be raised.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you both for a very interesting argument. And I meant what I said. There will always be questions about pleas, as they should be. So we are now going to adjourn until our third argument, which begins at 1:30. Justice Ziegler will be down to chat with you, and I'll be down to say hello for just a couple of minutes, and then I have to disappear to another meeting. We are adjourned.